Welcome all. Northern New Jersey Intergroup is proud to present Hot Topics. We are so grateful to our presenters, Janet B. and Jennifer C., for running this workshop for us. Janet lived in New Jersey until August of 2023 and now resides in Raleigh, North Carolina. Jennifer comes to us from South Carolina. Thank you both very much. Before we begin, a few things. Please know that the speakers portion of our program is being recorded, but the Q&A and sharing portion will not be recorded. We will have a very short seventh tradition and rest break, just one. And lastly, the recording will be available within the week on our website, which is njioa.org. And if possible, can you turn on your cameras, as we would love to see all your faces, except if you are eating, exercising, or need a personal break. So, that, let's get started. Would Robin please read the 12 steps of Overeaters Anonymous?
Hi, good afternoon, everybody. I'm Robin, compulsive overeater. The 12 steps. One, we admitted we were powerless over food, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Ten, continued to take personal inventory and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to compulsive overeaters and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Thank you. And will Gail please read the 12 traditions of Overeaters Anonymous?
Gail, compulsive overeater. 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon OA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as He may express Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for OA membership is a desire to stop eating compulsively. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or OA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the compulsive overeater who still suffers. Six, an OA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the OA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every OA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, OA should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, OA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Overeaters Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the OA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, films, television, or other public media of communication. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all these traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Thank you. And would Mary Ann please read the OA Unity with Diversity Policy?
Yes, thank you so much. I'm Mary Ann, a very grateful compulsive overeater. The Fellowship of Overeaters Anonymous encourages and promotes acceptance and inclusivity. All are welcome to join OA and are not excluded because of race, creed, nationality, religion, gender identity, sexual orientation, or any other attribute. We welcome all who share our compulsion. Everyone with a desire to stop eating compulsively is welcome in Overeaters Anonymous. Thank you.
Thank you. And now, it's my great pleasure to turn the program over to Janet and Jennifer.
Hey everyone, I'm Janet B., recovered compulsive eater and bulimic. Really great to be here, Eileen. Thank you for inviting me. I was in New Jersey, let's see, for almost 40 years and until I relocated down south. So just a quick history, and the way that it's going to go is Jennifer and I are going to give a series of five talks, each 20, 25 minutes-ish. So the topics are powerlessness, spiritual experience, top tips for newcomers, body image, and how to avoid or get out of relapse. So I'll start and I'll tell you a little bit about myself and powerlessness, and why this topic is so important to me is because it just wasn't explained to me at the beginning. So I'll just give you kind of a quick summary of my history. And before I dive in, I first came to OA when I was in high school. I grew up in Miami. I went to my first meeting. I was 15 years old. I was already a full-blown compulsive eater. I stole food. I stole money for food. And at my worst, I was binging and purging up to six times a day. And by the way, that was while I was in Overeaters Anonymous. In my first OA meeting, maybe I threw up once a week. 6.5 years later, still in OA, I was binging and purging up to six times a day. I had to have my esophagus surgically retightened because of the abuse I heaped on it. And I know a lot of times people show their before and after pictures. I was at my top weight about 30 pounds heavier than I am now. But if I were to find a real picture, I'd have to like go to some TV promo and find a picture of The Walking Dead because I was a zombie. I could be in a room with 100 people and feel like I was the only person on the planet. I was a compulsive liar. I was a crazy compulsive liar. And I made up ridiculous stories. Like I would cut myself with a razor, pretending I was mugged or raped to get attention, go to a hospital and get a fake rape exam, just because that's what I did. By the way, while I was going to Overeaters Anonymous meetings. And I continued this way. I continued binging and purging my first 6.5 years in Overeaters Anonymous, until by the grace of God, I was introduced to the 12 steps and to the God who I believe launches search and rescue missions for addicts. And once I surrendered my life to this God and committed to work the 12-step program, it was like a hand reached into my soul and yanked out the obsession. And by the grace of God, I've been in recovery over 40 years now. And I'm excited, and Jennifer is excited. We are really excited to talk about like this God who is alive and well and still working miracles. And she will really get into it on spiritual experience. But I want to talk to you about powerlessness because, you know, when I came in, I had this great relief that like, I'm not alone. Okay, I'm not the only overeater on a planet. And it would be like someone going to Diabetics Anonymous and saying, okay, now I'm going to get better because I see I'm not the only diabetic in the world, but they don't take insulin. They're not going to get better. And that's how it was. So I had this initial feeling of relief, but it didn't get better. It was like being in a Diabetics Anonymous meeting and no one talked about insulin. Maybe there were a couple of manuals on how to inject insulin and the importance of insulin on a shelf, but those books all had dust on them. No one really talked about it. They talked about rules and tools. So I tried to figure out why, in spite of going to meetings and having sponsors and doing assignments, I didn't get better. And I thought it was circumstances. So I blamed it on my lousy upbringing, which in hindsight wasn't lousy and was actually quite good. And I thought like, well, I binge because I'm miserable. So remember, I was in college And when I was 17, so about a year and a half into OA, this college boy who I had a crush on invited me to a Beach Boys concert. Those of you who are about my age know how cool the Beach Boys were back in the day. And so I'm like, I was over the moon happy. And I went out and I binged. And I said, oh, I must be binging to sabotage my happiness. No. Circumstances are never the cause of eating compulsively. And I think a lot of us have been to meetings where people have said, or I confess I've been guilty of saying it myself, I broke my abstinence because dot, dot, dot. And there was always a reason, right? My lousy boss, my rotten husband, my annoying, I mean, not my boss, not my husband, not my kids, but maybe other people would say that. There was always a reason. And it always had to do with circumstance. But what I've learned is that if we're eating compulsively, 100% of the time, it's because there's something wrong with our spiritual condition. It's never circumstances. Remember Jim in chapter 3 of the Big Book? He had his family, he had his job, and all was going well externally. But he failed to enlarge his spiritual life, and he got drunk. And we can contrast this with Bill Wilson in the chapter A Vision for You. The text on page 154 says, he was bitterly discouraged in a strange place, newly sober, discredited, almost broke. I mean, that sounds like horrible circumstances. But instead of getting drunk, he started Alcoholics Anonymous because, and I think this is important, he had surrendered his life to God and therefore he was protected. See, we don't not binge because we're good or because we work hard. The only way we're able to not binge is if we're protected by God. So it's not circumstance. It's not lack of good circumstance. So if it's not circumstance, was it lack of knowledge, right? Did I need to know better what foods were triggering me? I had food plan after food plan, then eliminated this binge food or that binge food. Now they call them red light foods. Again, back in the day, they just called them like trigger foods. It doesn't matter. I would have the perfect food plan. And I must have done that assignment to write a history of my compulsive eating at least 25 times. And guess what? I still couldn't stop because my problem wasn't lack of knowledge. Right? Imagine someone going to an oncologist, being shown an x-ray or a CAT scan and being told, see that spot there? That proves you have cancer. Now that you have the knowledge that you're a real cancer patient, go home and make your cancer cells stop multiplying. Of course, a doctor would never say that. And yet how many times was I told that if I really knew, if I really got it, that I was a compulsive eater, I could stop. Okay, so it's not circumstance, it's not lack of knowledge, maybe I didn't want it badly enough. During my first 6.5 years in OA, I had, I'm not exaggerating, about 50 different sponsors. And I kept getting dropped with people thinking and probably saying behind my back, oh, she doesn't want it badly enough. I think often people assume that if someone can't stop binging, that it's because that person doesn't really want to stop. We confuse desire with power. But on page 24 of our Big Book, it says that at a certain point in the drinking of every alcoholic, or for us, the eating of every compulsive eater, it says he passes into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking or overeating is of absolutely no avail. Powerless doesn't mean, you know, we go to a meeting, someone hands us a food plan that eliminates our binge foods, and then we magically have the power. That is not what it means. There I was, 6.5 years in, I was still binging. My binge is growing like more and more frequent with a larger quantity of food. I had the knowledge, I had the desire, but I didn't have the power. Okay, so what does it mean to have no power? Obviously, there wasn't a furry little creature that kept like shoving my hand into a bag of this or a carton of that. It was me who did it. So what does it mean to be powerless? And this is like so, so important to understand that the writers of the big book put the paragraph that explains it in italics on page 24. It says, we are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. Okay, that sounds like really weird. They're using words like memory, humiliation, defense. So let's break that down. Normally, my defense against doing something dangerous is my memory, right? The book talks about a hot stove. So let's say I'm about to touch a hot stove. Well, in my memory are all these data points telling me that touching a hot stove is dangerous. So if I'm about to touch a hot stove, my memory scans the data points. Oh, you touched a hot stove this time, you burnt your finger. You touched a hot stove, you know, you said, ouch, it burnt your hand. Generates a thought to run across the bridge to my conscious mind to say, stop, danger, hot stoves will burn you. And then I don't touch the hot stove. Or another example is I have a terrible cat allergy. So stored in my memory are all these data points of cat-induced asthma attacks, sinus infections, you know, runny noses, goopy eyes. So if I'm tempted to go into a pet store or visit a friend who has a cat, my memory scans the data points. You were near a cat, you got a sinus infection. You near a cat, you got sick. You had an asthma attack. You needed an inhaler. Generates a thought to run across the bridge to my conscious mind to say, stop, danger. Cats will give you an asthma attack. So again, my memory keeps me from danger. So now let's go to food. I think back to college. I used to binge, obviously, on a lot of things. But one thing that comes to mind is this certain kind of cookie. It came in a box of 20. So I would go downstairs, go to the drugstore to buy my box of 20 to tell myself I'm just going to have one or two. We all know how that story ended. The whole box would be gone, sometimes a second box. So in my memory were all these data points of how I tell myself I'd just eat one cookie, but I'd end up eating the whole box. So there I go, about to go down. I remember it clearly, the Duane Reade drugstore, to buy my box of cookies to just eat one. And my memory scans the thoughts. You said you were going to have one, but you ate the whole box. You said you'd have one or two, but you ate two boxes. You made yourself throw up. You couldn't get out of bed the next day. You gain weight. You're miserable. Don't do it. Generates that thought to run across the bridge to my conscious mind. Except unlike with hot stoves and cats, when it came to food, the bridge was broken and the thought couldn't get across. My memory failed to hold me in check and I had no defense against the first compulsive bite. People say sometimes at meetings, keep the memory green. By the way, that's not in the big book. We don't have the power to keep the memory green. That's what it means to be powerless. I can't remember strongly enough to stop. When it came to food, the bridge between my memory and my conscious mind was broken. Now, for someone who's just like a hard drinker or a hard eater, it doesn't work that way. I had a friend, Elle, and her husband saw that if he had just one glass of wine, he couldn't stop. So he said, you know what? I can't drink. I will never again have one glass of wine because that'll set it off. And as far as I know, he has not picked up wine. He has the allergy, right? His body, when he has a glass of wine, breaks out in craving for more. But it's only an allergy because he remembers that if he has one drink, he won't be able to stop. What it means to be powerless is that we are unable to bring into our conscious mind the memories of the suffering and humiliation, even if it was just a day ago. We can't do it. That bridge is broken. Once broken, it can't ever be repaired. And for me, I was hopeless. Just like Bill Wilson, when he realized he was hopeless, and he said on page 8 of the big book, no words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. Food was my master, and I had a broken bridge. Well, so what do we do? Can we fix that bridge between our memory and our conscious mind? We cannot. Once it's broken, it will always be broken. So like, how did I recover? And how do we all recover? What do we do when our bridges are broken? And the answer is we build another bridge. We build a bridge to God. And it starts with willingness. Now, remember, willingness doesn't mean being willing to stick to a food plan. It means that, but it means more than that. Remember, I'm powerless to stick to a food plan without divine intervention, without a miracle. Willingness means being willing to do the work that will allow God to come in and remove the obsession. I've heard it said, Herb Kay says this, willingness allows grace to enter. Isn't that pretty? Willingness allows grace to enter. And on page 58 of our big book, it says, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then, I say then and only then, are you ready to work the steps? So if a person isn't willing to go to any length, they shouldn't expect to recover. So it's important to admit we're powerless. Why? Because, I mean, who's going to go through chemo except someone who has late stage cancer and is told that that's their only option? Who is going to go through this work, which means self-searching, leveling of my pride, living a life of rigorous honesty unless I have to? So I admit I'm powerless, but powerless alone won't do it. We need to have a spiritual experience. And my friend Jennifer is going to talk about that now.
Thank you, Janet. Spiritual experience. My name is Jennifer C. I'm recovered in Greenville, South Carolina. So what is a spiritual experience as defined by the big book? It's a personality change that is sufficient to bring about recovery from food addiction. It's a psychic change. It's a spiritual awakening. These are different interchangeable terms that the big book uses to describe the same thing. I've been changed in a way that allows me to live my life without excess food as my solution. Does that mean I'm never going to want excess food? It doesn't. It means that I'm not going to use excess food as a solution to wanting the excess food. It's not a solution for anything, not even wanting to eat. To fully understand my need for a spiritual experience, right? To fully understand my need for it, I have to first come to terms with this disease experience. I need a spiritual experience. Why? Because I have a disease. And my disease experience brings me to a point of complete hopelessness. Restless, irritable, and discontent. As defined by the doctor's opinion, I am literally stuck in a cycle. The cycle is this. I get restless, I get irritable, I get discontent. I get unhappy, I get ungrateful, I get irritable, anxious, depressed, sad, regretful. There's so many synonyms for those three words that Bill chose in the big book: restless, irritable, discontent. My mind convinces me that the ease and comfort that I need come through the food. My mind convinces me that using the food is going to be worth it, or I know it's not going to be worth it, but it doesn't matter. I do it anyway. My mind convinces me to make the same mistake over and over and over again. And I can't permanently change things. Step one, I can't permanently change things. I can implement behavior modification. I can use my willpower, but I cannot permanently produce change. I don't have the power to do that. I can't control anything. If I try to control, it results in a greater loss of control. That's my experience with food. The more I try to control the food, the more I lose control. Step two, since my spiritual experience comes from working the steps, that's how I get my spiritual experience, right? I work these steps. God can make me sane. Step two. Step one, I'm insane with food, but not just food, but it has to start with food. Step two, God can make me sane, but I'm not crazy. Do you keep doing the same thing over and over again? Are you severely imbalanced in your eating, your thinking, and your doing? You need sanity. I remember when I didn't believe that I was insane. I just knew that I had a problem with food, and it was a process. It was a spiritual experience for me to truly believe that I needed to be restored to sanity. The spiritual experience is a process. If you are here today, you're in a spiritual experience. It's happening. Wherever you are in that experience, if you haven't had your awakening yet that allows you to live your life without excess food, you're still in the process. You're here. There's a disease process and there's a spiritual experience that's happening once you come in to this program and begin working the steps. I have to ask for a spiritual experience. That's the first thing that I need to understand, is that my spiritual experience, my psychic change, the personality change that comes through a relationship with God, I have to ask for it. My creator has all that I need, and I need to ask for this psychic change that will be sufficient to relieve the food obsession. I go to God and I ask for it. So first I have to recognize my desperate need for it. The big book says that's the only thing that's going to save me from this food addiction is a psychic change, an entire psychic change. That's what the big book says that I need in order to not destroy myself with food anymore. So I need to ask for it. I need to begin asking God for a spiritual experience. So one, I recognize my desperate need for it, and not just the psychic change, but my need for God. Not just the psychic change, but my need for God, my need for the power of God in my life. I need to see my own insanity. I need to see that I believe lies around food, lies that cause me to eat addictively, lies that cause me to break my abstinence over and over and over and over and over again. I believe lies. In the moment, I don't know that they're lies. Like Janet said, keeping it green is insufficient according to the big book, right? So my perception is distorted. I can't eat without intervention. I need new eating. I need new thinking. That's what I need to become convinced of in order to start asking for this spiritual experience, in order to start doing the work. If I don't think I need a spiritual experience, then I can keep trying to follow diets. I can keep trying to follow food plans, and it can keep failing me over and over and over again, because what I really need is an entire psychic change. This is a change that happens in my soul. It's a change that happens in my soul. So I need new eating. I need new thinking. The insanity around food is a gift to me. Let me say that one more time. My insanity around food is a gift to me, because it is a tangible way for me to see my desperate need for God. The more insane I am with food, the more I can't evade the reality that I need God. The big book says that this process is good for everybody, not just addicts, right? The big book says that we all need God. My relationship with food has forced me into a place where I see this need for God. I see my need for a spiritual experience. I see my need for a psychic change. So how do I get it? I get it by taking the 12 steps as directed in the big book. I do the assignments. I listen to the podcasts. I go to the meetings. But what happens when I do that, when I go to the meetings, when I listen to the podcasts, and when I do the assignments, those don't give me the spiritual experience. The assignments don't give it to me. The meetings don't give it to me. And listening to the podcast don't give me the spiritual experience. But what happens is that the more I expose myself to the light, the more I expose myself to the truth, the more I allow myself to have this experience. It comes from God. God gives me the experience that changes me in such a way that I no longer need food. I no longer need food. So I read the big book. I pray. I ask God. I invite God in. Well, what do I do if I don't believe in God? The big book says that if I've been crushed by a self-imposed crisis. If I have been crushed, I have to answer a question. Here's the proposition. Is God everything or nothing? What's my choice to be? That's what it tells me. It says that I have to answer that question if I've been crushed. If I've been crushed, I have to answer that question. So then the question is, have you been crushed? Have you been crushed by this food addiction? Have you tried over and over and over again to get your way out of it and have not been able to? Have you been crushed by it yet? And if you can honestly say that you have, then the big book tells me that I have to answer a question. And the question is, either God is or isn't. What's my choice going to be? And then I begin to seek God. Once I answer that question, I seek God for that spiritual awakening, for that spiritual experience, for that psychic change. I do the work. I expose myself to the light. Where there are lies, I expose myself to the truth. These steps gradually give me my spiritual experience, because here's what happens as a result of these steps. In step one, I believe I need God, right? I believe I'm powerless. I'm told that only God can save me at this point. I can't save myself. I have no power to do it. I've tried over and over and over again. My self-will has failed me, completely failed me. I can't permanently change my relationship with food. God can. Step two, God can. God can change this. God is a miracle worker. Can I believe that? Do I see that in the lives of other people that are speaking that have what I want? Do I believe that God can do this for me? Step three, my will and my life. I no longer own the rights to myself. I offer it. I offer it. I offer it. I let go. I have no other choice. I have no power. God does. I need God. Step four, I start taking responsibility. I humble myself before God and I start taking responsibility. And step five, why is it so important to share with another person? Because I begin to experience acceptance instead of shame. Love where there was condemnation, illumination for ignorance, and truth for lies. This is an experience that the big book says will connect me more with God, with my creator. How so? How does sharing my four-step inventory connect me more with God? Because I'm able to share the deepest, darkest places of myself with someone else, and I'm able to receive acceptance. That is who God is. So step six, entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. Get ready to have God remove them. Once again, I'm powerless to remove the things I see in step five. I once again surrender and say, God, have all of me. First, I'm powerless over the food, and then I'm powerless over my defects of character. I offer them once again to God. Step seven, that beautiful prayer, my creator, I'm now willing that you should have all of me. I surrender once again. I surrender once again, and I ask God to change me. So all of a sudden, it started with food, and now it has become, I need change. I need true change. Because if all I need is food freedom, then I don't really need a spiritual experience. But if I begin to understand that I need change, true change in the deepest places of who I am, that's when God says, okay, honey, now you're ready. So I keep taking responsibility through eight and nine. I keep asking God. I keep asking God. I keep taking responsibility. Step 10 is all about that. It's continuously asking God, right? It's continuously asking God to remove the things that we saw previously in the steps. We ask God to remove them over and over and over again. So here's the thing about this spiritual experience on a daily basis. Step 11 prayer and meditation. So as an addict, I have the disease of more. I want more. And I want more. And I want more. And I want more. So the awesomeness of God, I get more and more and more with God. God's like, the more you get, the more you want. Prayer and meditation, it never gets old. It never gets old. And when it does, guess what? I have step 12. I get to give it away. I get to give it away. And the more I give it away, the more I want. And so this spiritual experience is an experience of more, but I'm safe. I'm safe now to want more. I'm safe now to need more. And I'm going to keep getting more because God never runs out. So I get delivered from this disease experience where all I want is more. I'm never satisfied. I'm restless. I'm irritable. I'm unfulfilled. I'm unfulfilled. And I get delivered from that way of life into a way of life where God says, keep asking for more and I'll keep giving you more of me. And so that for me is the definition of my spiritual experience, is that now I know where to go and I don't need food as a solution. And it doesn't mean that life is perfect. And it doesn't mean that I'm never tempted, because the big book tells me that I'm going to be tempted. What it means is that I now have a solution, and it's never, ever food. It's never, ever food. And with that, I pass.
Thanks, Jennifer. Okay, this talk is really entitled Top Tips for Newcomers, but it should be called Things That I Wish Someone Told Me During My First 6.5 Years, But People Didn't. So these are just things that I think are important. So page 58 of our big book just kind of gives guidance for someone who's new. It says, if you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. Okay, what do we have, right? So Jennifer talked about it, a spiritual experience. And our big book really defines it on page 25. It says, the great fact is just this and nothing less, that our Creator has entered our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things in ourselves which we could never accomplish for ourselves. So if we want that, and by the way, once we have a spiritual experience, it's like it changes the soil of our souls. So our souls are like inhospitable to the illness of compulsive eating. There's like a new soul soil there. So if we want that freedom from compulsive eating by having a spiritual experience, it says, then you have to be willing to go to any lengths to get it. So that means willing to do whatever our sponsor tells us to do. And, you know, people debate whether we should interview sponsors or not. My opinion is, yes, I want to interview them to make sure this person has what I want. Has this person worked the steps in the big book? And do they now have a relationship with God? My sponsor says that it's the job of a sponsor to put the sponsee's hand in God's hand. So I interview them to make sure they have what I want. However, I do not interview them to say, what do you require people to do? Because if I don't like what you're asking me to do, I'm moving on. We find someone who has what we want, and then we become willing to go to any lengths to get it. Now, sometimes when we talk about spiritual experience and God coming in and helping us, a lot of times people say, I want it, but I'm not worthy. Either I've done some really bad things, or this is a vague sense of guilt. And that's why the founders of this program put a 9-step in, because we've all done some really bad things. So there is a mechanism for making amends in step 9. But sometimes we just have this vague sense of being unworthy, of shame, like I'm not worthy. And I think there's two options to that. One, we can like go to therapy and spend, I don't know, like $5,000-$10,000 and have a therapist help us get better self-esteem. Or we could realize worthiness is never a requirement. It doesn't say if you want what we have and are worthy to receive it, then you can work the steps. The only thing that's required is willingness. So I would say that we need to ask ourselves, if we're new or not so new, am I willing to go to any lengths? Am I willing to do whatever it takes? And I'll just tell you some of the things that I ask my sponsees to do. And again, that I wish someone had told me. Nobody ever told me how critical it was to be honest. I mean, we read in meetings the beginning of chapter 5, but no one really sat me down and said, you know, honey, if you're not honest, you may as well stop spending your evenings in church basements and your time making outreach calls, because you're not going to get better. God won't coexist with dishonesty. It's like I'm taking a black pen and writing the words, keep out God, across my heart. Like, this program demands honesty. I had a friend who was a recovered alcoholic, and he said, when an alcoholic first comes around, he can stop lying and he can stop stealing. So right from day one, we have to be honest. The other thing that I tell my sponsees and that I think is important for newcomers is to spend time with God. When I got my sponsor who took me through the steps, I wasn't told spend time with God in the morning, but I gave myself an assignment to spend 45 minutes in the morning. I said 15 on spiritual reading, like to find something that spiritually excites us, that makes us want to get closer to God. 15 minutes in prayer and 15 minutes in meditation. I assign that to myself. I tell my sponsees they have to spend at least 30 minutes in the morning with God, because this whole program is about getting a relationship with God. And how do you get a relationship with someone if you don't spend time with them, right? Who of us would ever got married if our husband said, yeah, I want to marry you, but I don't want to hang out with you? I mean, that would be ridiculous. So we have to spend time with God, getting to know him. Another thing, don't put yourself in temptation's way. And if you're just starting, you want to make your life small, in the sense that I once had a sponsee, and just as she was starting to work the steps, she was starting to take salsa dancing and was doing that like 6 nights a week. And she says, but it brings me happiness. And I say, no, you know, in the book for the early alcoholics, they had actual inpatient hospitalization. That generally doesn't happen here, although some people may choose to do that. But I would say, if you're new, act like you're an outpatient rehab. So you go to work, you take care of your kids, you take care of your hygiene, you do enough exercise to stay healthy. Of course, if you're an exercise bulimic, you want to put parameters on that with your sponsor. But other than that, you want to immerse yourself in recovery. How? Well, first, don't put yourself in temptation's way. So at the beginning, might not be a great idea to go to restaurants. I remember when I first started at work, they were having a pizza party. I just had my own meal and I ate it separate because I couldn't handle being around it at the beginning. Of course, one of the beautiful promises of this program is that we'll be able to like go anywhere and have freedom, but not at the beginning. So we should see what our own personal temptations and limits are and be careful. And again, immerse yourself in recovery. Call recovered people. When I start sponsoring someone, I'll give her a list of about 20 phone numbers of recovered people. And I know a lot of you have been called by my new sponsees. And I tell them to make 3 calls a day and not to just say, hi, I'm making an outreach call. Because when people call me and they say, hi, I'm making an outreach call, it's like, okay. Or if someone I don't know calls me and says, hi, I'm calling, I want to know how your day's going. And like, what if I'm having a really crappy day, or I just had a fight with my husband? I'm not going to tell a perfect stranger. Let's be honest, I'm not. So I tell my sponsees, like, don't just call and say, hi, I'm making an outreach call. Don't call and say, hi, how was your day? Call with a question. Call and say, you know, I'm new, and what's hard for me is believing that there's a God. Or I'm new and, you know, I'm reading the chapter Bill's story. What's your favorite What's your favorite line or paragraph in that, and why? Like, call with something to discuss so you can build a relationship with someone. And then again, I said, I usually give my sponsees about 20 different phone numbers. If you call someone and you feel, wow, this person has some good recovery, ask them for two or three phone numbers of other strong people. Like, hey, do you have a couple numbers you can give me of strong people? So again, make the calls, not just to check them off a list, but to start forming relationships, right? Because that's one of the great promises of our program, right? Frequent contact with newcomers and each other is the bright spot in our lives. So we can develop relationships, meetings. I generally ask my sponsees to go to a meeting a day, unless, you know, if it's a single mother with like three jobs and four kids, obviously it's going to be different. So it's a case by case basis. But again, I want to pack their time when they're not at work or taking care of their family obligations, their hygiene and their health. They are immersed in this program. And so I tell the meetings to go to that I think are good meetings. At the beginning, you want to be in strong meetings. I also encourage someone, like, out of all the meetings you go to, try and make one meeting a week at a local meeting, because it's good to get local fellowship. And this way people will see you, and they'll see you start out struggling, but then they'll see you, okay, huh, it's been 2 weeks, then 2 months, then 2 years, and they'll see you and you can help locally. But I would say it's most important at the beginning to go to the meetings where you are going to get good, correct recovery information and support. As far as food plans, virtual wars have been fought on, should there be a food plan? What kind of food plan? How? So I will just say this, you know, again, our big book talks about love and tolerance of others as our code. So if someone has a different food plan or a different theory of food plans, it's okay. I've had sponsors who don't need to have food plans. They can just sit down and, you know what to eat. I cannot. So I have a food plan, and it tells me how much of each food category I can have. I would say, especially at the beginning, to have a structured food plan weighed and measured and committed before breakfast. Why? Well, if you're an alcoholic, right, then you know that if you have even one sip of alcohol, you're in trouble, right? You're off your plan. If we don't have a food plan, how do we know if we're eating compulsively? And if we have a loose food plan, you know, how do we know? So this is how we know. And there's just great freedom in it. And like, this is my food plan. This is what I'm going to eat. So committed. Now I tell my sponsees, once it's committed, I say, you can commit whatever you want in accordance with your food plan. But once it's committed, you don't get to change it. No, yeah, I committed fish, but I feel like having chicken. Or I committed fish, but I don't have fish. Well, really? Why'd you commit it? Oh, I didn't look in my fridge. Yeah, I can go to the grocery store and buy some fish. I mean, if there's a hurricane or something, or okay. But generally, we're supposed to check to see what we have in our house and plan accordingly. And as far as the food, something again, I told myself when I first started, I made up a prayer to say before each meal. And it went like this, like, God, thank you for this food. Please help me use it to fuel my body to best do thy will. I would just say that before meals. So we pray to fuel our bodies to best do God's will. And that leads me to the next thing, which I think is so important. Self-sacrifice. The big book says, I think it's page 14, if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through, doesn't say prayer and meditation, through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead and would surely drink. So it's telling us that there are going to be trials and low spots ahead. There just are. This doesn't promise us like rainbows and puppies all the time. But it says we can survive it, and we can survive it abstinently. How? If we're fortified. You know, it's like, I can't just go and, you know, all of a sudden, I don't know if a tree branch comes down, lift it. But if I've been going to the gym and I've been doing bicep curls for a couple months, then I'll be stronger and able to do it. Not the best example, but my point is we fortify our souls against trials and low spots by work and self-sacrifice for others. Sitting in my nice air-conditioned house on my comfy couch, making an outreach call is generally not a self-sacrifice. What am I giving up? By definition, self-sacrifice means I have to be giving something up that I want in order to help someone else. And it says work. It's not work to make a 2-minute outreach call. Here's work. When we're through the steps, sponsoring other people is work because that takes our time, our effort. But even that, for me, I like sponsoring. I like talking at meetings. I love doing stuff like this. I hate cleaning my house. So I actually had to set a commitment with my sponsor that I will spend X amount of time a day cleaning my house, because for me, that's a self-sacrifice. And that's where I'm apt to be selfish. So here are some things that some of my sponsees have done, you know, who are new, early stage. Go down to a Target or a Walmart and either put carts away for 15 minutes or go inside and fold clothes or put the shoes in the shoe rack away for a period of time. I had one sponsee who was doing that so much, they came and asked her to fill out a job application. I have another sponsee who just told me she gathered up some old pocketbooks and was filling them with, I guess, toothbrushes and soap and stuff, and is going to go distribute them to homeless people. Work and self-sacrifice, to give of ourselves, to do something that takes time. And as far as even when we're sponsoring, how much to sponsor? So the book says we spend much of our spare time in this work. So the way I look at it is, you know, I could be a slug. I love to read, and I could curl up on the couch with a novel and, you know, just go back and forth between that and Netflix all day, every day. If I'm watching as much Netflix as I want, I'm not doing enough work and self-sacrifice for others. So I would say early on, so what I tell my sponsees is every single day, an act of self-sacrifice that benefits other people, and that's a sacrifice for you. So you think about it, if we're doing that, if we're spending time with God in the morning, making at least 3 phone calls a day to recovered people, going to a meeting a day, looking for ways to be of use to others, we're starting to have a shift in the way that we think, right? And then I would say, if you have a sponsor, you want to make sure she's taking you through the steps. And I would say, go quickly. If you get an assignment, and I generally don't give my sponsees deadlines, but I know the ones who are going to recover are the ones who you know, I say, here's the assignment. We'll do something in the book. I'll make them endure a podcast of mine and then say, text, you know, write this, text me when you're done. And the ones who text me in a day or so, I feel thumbs up, good chance. If someone takes like 5 days, like, yeah, let's go faster. I mean, this is what we are supposed to be doing when we are new, devoting all our time to it like we're an outpatient rehab. I would say practice gratitude. And, you know, a lot of us have the app where we like, or we'll write our gratitudes. But remember, this program is about a relationship with God. So we want to actively thank God. Ask him for help in the morning. Thank him for what he did for us each day. You know, in the book, it says life is better when lived on a spiritual plane. So as much as we can, we want to live on a spiritual plane. So what does that mean? Even from the beginning, it's to do what I think God would do or God would have me do, and not to worry about the results. And if I don't believe there's God, or I'm not sure, I can say, if there was a God, well, for sure, he wouldn't want me to steal, right? We can start with that. He wouldn't want me to rob a bank. He would probably want me to be nice to the people in my family. We do what we know. We live on a spiritual plane, do what we think God would have us, and leave the results up to him. And then the last thing I want to say is we want to surrender the number on the scale. I generally tell my sponsees to weigh themselves every 2 weeks. And the reason is, so we know if the food plan's working, right? If they lose too much weight too quickly, it's like, okay, maybe we should add some food. If they're not losing weight, okay, maybe we should adjust. But that's it. Like, that's the only reason we really weigh ourselves. I mean, our goal is to get down to a healthy body weight so that we can be of use to God and others, but we surrender the number on the scale. And again, my friend Jennifer is going to talk more about that when she talks about body image. And with that, I will pass now and kick it back to Eileen for some announcements.
Well, first, thank you. Thank you both, Janet. Thank you, Jennifer. We're going to have a very short break. First, the seventh tradition break, and then take a few moments to get up, stretch, whatever you need to do. According to our seventh tradition, we are self-supporting through our own contributions. This is, of course, voluntary. World Service suggests a $5 donation, but please give what you can if you can. And I'm going to post our seventh tradition instructions in the chat. Thank you, and we'll be back in a few moments.